G'day, this is David Rutledge, welcoming you to the Earshot podcast. Great to have your company. If you're up for hearing songs about violence and murder and bloodshed, and at the end of the day, let's face it, who doesn't love songs about all that, then you're probably going to go looking for punk or hip-hop or the festering badlands of metal. Where you might not expect to find blood-curdling lyrical content is in folk music. But in fact, the murder ballad is a very old folk tradition, and some of those murder ballads can make Tupac sound like Katy Perry. We've got more corpses than a Tarantino film coming up, but served with acoustic guitars, and there's a strong language warning. The program's produced by Caitlin Gibson.
Every town needs a bad guy.
You take the thing that you find most precious, the thing that you most fear losing, and you sacrifice that to the god, because then at least you're grappling with the biggest fear.
I feel like I've been to hell and back.
I'll cut your throat and drink your fucking blood like wine.
I one night I was sitting back looking at my record shelf, and I realized I had a lot of records about death and dying.
What these songs are trying to do is talk about fears and desires that we don't really have words for.
It seemed like at the time it was a really good way of therapy, of trying to work through the issues I was confronting by these deaths in my family.
I've been a bad, bad girl.
They're beautiful, they're horrible. They're about love, but they're about death. I think that's why we dream at night, and I think that's what these murder ballads can do for us too, is they purge these dark feelings that we don't know how to purge in another way.
Yes, please don't kill me. I won't be bad no more.
Violence, blood, murder. Punk songs and rap lyrics are littered with these nowadays, but dark themes aren't new to music. Pretty Polly, Knoxville Girl, and Stagger Lee are all songs that are hundreds, if not a thousand years old. And they're all songs about murder.
We went to take an evening walk about a mile from town. I picked a stick up off the ground and knocked that fire girl down.
When I heard Knoxville Girl for the first time, it really was a very strange experience, and I still find that song fascinating and compelling in these odd ways. It certainly doesn't make you feel the way it should make you feel. It's a song that's about a murder, yet it's really beautiful and really makes me feel good.
She never spoke another word. I only beat her more.
Hello, I'm Rennie Sparks. I'm the lyricist and bass player for the Handsome Family. It's not so much that I want to murder people or I'm obsessed with murder, but there's something about dark songs that it just feels wonderful.
Like myths and fairy tales, even Bible stories too, these songs teach us about good and evil and who to be afraid of. For women, that lesson is often made brutally clear.
So this guy takes this woman out for a walk, and then as soon as he gets her in the woods, when normally that's where they would go have some kissing, lay down together, he picks up a stick and starts bashing her over the head, and that's when her blood starts pouring, is when she becomes beautiful.
If it were tracked as a Venn diagram and you had one circle that was music that overlapped another circle that was murder, a good portion of where they overlapped would be sex. Sex was one of the main motivations behind most of these murders. People wanting to cover up their sexual exploits, cover up getting somebody pregnant, cover up their lust, or cover up their desire. I'm Christopher King, and I collect old 78s from the 20s and 30s, and I tend to write about where music and death intersect. I guess the repression of our sexual impulses has led to probably some of the best music ever made.
Songs like The Knoxville Girl were already 100 years old by the time the Lewin brothers made this 1956 recording. But it's these more recent versions that are far more likely to seem strange and disjointed. Originally, it takes place on the moors of 17th century England. She's slaughtered by the cruel miller's apprentice to cover up an unplanned pregnancy.
The original stories had a lot of sense to them. Yeah, this is how this girl got into trouble. But gradually we took out all the parts of these songs that made any sense or had any logical motivation. But I love Knoxville Girl because it's completely irrational every step of the way. None of it makes any sense, but it makes perfect sense. I think that's what happened with a lot of these songs when they came to America, where it was a very strictly Christian country, where there was no room for any kind of spring sexuality. All that stuff that is just second nature, I think, to Europeans, you know, in their background. But in America, that stuff was not okay. So all the sexual motivation behind these songs were just completely removed because the singers were uncomfortable with them. And then you get these songs that are so strangely motivated that they become even more sexual, I think. The descriptions of the mud and the blood and the golden curls and her dark eyes, you become really aware of this woman's body as he attacks her, which I think is the opposite of what people wanted when they took out all the sexual stuff.
Sweet William Rose one winter's morn, pray Lord to me speak true and tell me of that long lost love between Lady Maud.
I hear women all the time saying those songs make them uncomfortable because women are often the victims and they make the women look helpless and passive and the men are always the ones with the sticks and the guns and things. But I've never had that problem with it because I guess I just don't think of them as real life. They always have lily white hands, which is, I guess, a way of signifying the fact that they're basically dead to begin with. They're always virginal and pure and perfect and sweet and never really put up a fight and always completely surprised and completely gullible. They're not real. I think we come up with them again and again because we need these kind of characters, the evil evil and the good good. My feeling is there probably were many more songs that had women who were the seductresses and the killers, but over time I think that they've fallen by the wayside. But we do need scary men in the forest still.
America's fear of pagan sexuality is not the only factor to have changed these songs. The limited physical space on a 78 RPM disc meant that the earliest recordings of these ancient songs required some seriously clever editing.
Oh, go dig a hole in the meadow. Oh, go dig a hole in the ground. Go dig a hole in the meadow. Let me lay pretty Corey down.
I think that had you have heard a murder ballad in the teens or 20s without the benefit of the 78 RPM format, i.e. if you happened to go to some village in remote Kentucky and you asked to hear the best balladeer there and he pulls out his banjo, you wouldn't hear a 3 minute and 30 second version. You'd hear a 15 minute version. When these balladeers were confronted with this new technology and were told you only have 3.5 minutes to tell this story, they came up with this just ingenious way of leaving out the right details.
Highway robbers are coming.
The Darling Corey by B.F. Shelton is probably the top of my list because of how hypnotic it is and how effective he is at drawing the listener in, because he very appropriately does not say knife, he says a lethal weapon, and so your mind drifts in the direction of, oh, was it a gun, a rock, a knife? And so I think he cleverly crafted the ending of verses so that your mind starts to wander, you know, all these different details that he leaves out, it actually pulls a listener in.
Matter of it's completely factual. Just in the songs, it's just making the story compelling. So if something gets trimmed off that's factual and something gets substituted that's more, makes the song propel more and pulls you into the story more, I'm all for that. I mean, it's not journalism after all.
Well, I caught a pretty Polly the whole live long night.
Jeff Lang is an Australian musician who stumbled on this tradition of old murder songs very early on in his career.
And I left the next morning before it was light.
It's just got to be compelling for me. And, you know, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. I mean, there's plenty of examples of that in kind of the bad man ballads in the States, where they're based on, at the core, something that actually happened, but it gets embellished to make it more, you know, it's like, kind of like how the news works too, isn't it?
Letter to a clearing, and what did they spy? But a fresh lit a grave and a spade lying by.
Nobody ever gets killed anywhere mundane. They're always at the edge of town or in the darkness or in a cave or down by the river. And I think that's part of it also, is this need to go out into the forest to confront nature that we all have, but we're all terrified of. And we prefer to live in towns, but we also know that there's something in the dark that we're still afraid of.
Knoxville Girl isn't the only murder ballad to be affected by this move from Europe to the brave new world of America.
Pretty Polly, for instance, that's a very old English ballad, but it's the second or third most recognizable murder ballad in the United States. I mean, the Stanley Brothers recorded, I'm sure a lot of other people have recorded after the Stanley Brothers, but it was recorded at least a dozen times during the pre-war era alone.
Oh, she knelt down before him, pleading for life. She knelt down before him, pleading for life. Let me be a saint, old girl, if I can't be.
In some of the versions, she becomes like a real harpy. She becomes this bird that attacks the killer as he's trying to escape on a ship. But that doesn't really fit into the American mindset.
Certainly a song like Pretty Polly is interesting. It's got almost as many lyrics that are missing in the final version of the song. And it seems to be an example of what happens a lot with the folk process of songs that are passed on. They remember what they can. They embellish bits as they, you know, forget other bits.
He went to the jailhouse, and what did he say? Kill Pretty Polly and trying to get away.
Pretty Polly, a song older than America, is part of an ancient tradition, a tradition that was kept alive in part because of a sort of lucky accident of history.
When the Scotch-Irish came over to, I guess, have a combination of economic opportunity as well as religious freedom, many people settled in the hollers in Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina and lived this sustenance way of life for 200 or 300 years with very little contact with the outside world. You know, there were trains that came, but they were pretty far away. There wasn't really much contact with the urban environment. So they not only kept these things that they brought with them from England, they sort of took a deep sense of pride in them.
Home is across the Blue Ridge Mountains. The Appalachians were as isolating as any ocean. In 1916, when an English folklorist named Cecil Sharp ventured deep into the mountains, he found people who spoke English and looked English, but it seemed from another time. He said, back home, no one remembered these old songs anymore. But Cecil Sharp was an academic, and he wrote down all the lyrics that he heard in a book. For these voices, this old-time music, to be heard today, the recording industry had to be born.
Money. It was all motivated by money. That, you know, people like Lomax or Cecil Sharp or other people, they had these ulterior motives of collecting things for scholarly activities or maybe even lofty notions of preserving culture. But record companies, they actually wanted to make bank. And so when they realized going into a studio and recording, say, Fiddlin' John Carson in 1922, that they could sell hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these discs to poor white Southerners and make money off of them, that to them was a really great idea.
At that time, recording poor white farmers or black musicians traveling through the South was cheap.
All right, boys, follow my lead.
Remember that line in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, when George Clooney's character needs to make some quick and easy money?
Hello. We hear that you pay good money to sing into a can.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I've
seems that that same era, recording companies were going around and finding talent to make those old 78 records. And, well, they found African Americans like Mississippi John Hurt, who did a great version of Stag Lee, and white performers like the Carter Family. And, well, you go down the list.
Police officer, how can it be? You can rest everybody but cruel Stag Lee, that bad man. Oh, cruel Stag Lee.
Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson, and Skip James, the founding fathers of the blues, all stumbled into these makeshift studios, just like Mississippi John Hurt, here singing his own version of an African-American murder ballad called Stag Lee in 1928.
You done stole my stuff and head. I'm bound to take your life, that bad man. Oh, cruel Stag Lee.
Even earlier, though, there was Jelly Roll Morton, a dandy gold-toothed jazz pianist who claimed he invented jazz. Jelly Roll was touring the country, playing music as early as 1904, but he dropped off the recording scene during the Depression, when companies had to ration the shellac they used to make the 78s, and black musicians were the first to be dropped.
If you don't leave my fucking man alone.
He learned to play in whorehouses at the age of 14 and picked up a wide-ranging repertoire.
You won't know what.
But in this recording, sitting around the piano, remembering old songs he used to play, he's smooth, but also dark.
I'll cut your throat and drink your fucking bloodline.
Perhaps they're the kind of parlor songs that were common 100 years ago or so.
Bitch, I'll cut your fucking throat, drink your blood like wine.
And we thought rap music was brutal.
There's tons of songs out there, like rap songs about murder or punk rock songs that are really violent, but they don't have the same effect whatsoever. They can be full of bloodshed, but because they don't have that beautiful lightness to them, they don't create that swirling of opposites inside your head. A murder ballad needs to have that pretty melody to go along with it. It needs beautiful harmonies, and it needs to feel simple and pure to have the full effect of its magic, I think.
Right to the barren ground, your big black ass will go.
To me, that's part of the majesty, the power of those things, is that they're actually very simply structured. They actually grab you by the neck and they pull you in and they don't let go. I'm one of the very proud owners of one of two known copies of Geechee Wiley and L.V. Thomas's Last Kind Word Blues, quite possibly the most powerful 78 side ever recorded.
I'm gonna cut your throat, baby. I'll look down in your face.
There's that line where Geechee Wiley says, I slit your face, baby. I watch the blood run down in your face. The way she says it, I mean, that's pretty brutal, but the way she sings it is actually very sensual, don't you think?
I'll look down in your face.
Geechee Wiley and L.V. Thomas only made one record that we know of. But with lyrics like that, the mystery surrounding these women has always fascinated collectors. Maybe the violence, sex, and the murder isn't pure allegory, but drawn from their own lives.
This woman, L.V. Thomas, was sort of an underground lesbian and had formed this relationship with Geechee Wiley. Geechee in the old American vernacular means very, very dark, very black.
My mama told me.
They recorded these six sides in Grafton, Wisconsin in 1930. At that point, Geechee Wiley had killed her husband and fled with L.V. Thomas, and she sort of vanished at that point. Geechee Wiley still is elusive. When you look at the music from the late 1920s and early 1930s, that was essentially the last time in the United States where people learned how to sing or how to play directly from the members of their community, directly from their family, without any outside influences. after that time period, everybody learned from recordings.
By the 1950s, the airwaves were so thick with radio, you could wrap a tin can with wire, hold it to a fence post, and hear the latest hits. Folk music was out of fashion, but technology had meant old murder ballads were on records, stashed away in attics, basements, and cardboard boxes, collecting dust, but waiting to be rediscovered.
I'm leaving you, baby. I know it's a pity. To that Neverland City, sweet old Kokomo.
Part of the dynamic of the song, like Charles Seeger said, a folk song doesn't have a text, it has texts, and doesn't have a tune, it has tunes. That's the definition.
Soon enough, coffee houses in New York City were full of folk revivalists like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, making a name for themselves singing Knoxville Girl, Darling Cora, and The House Carpenter.
Here's a story about a ghost come back from out in the sea, come to take his bride away from the house carpenter.
And again, these old murder ballads rose up.
Well met my old true love. Well met, cried she. I've just returned from the salt sea, and it's all for the love of thee.
I do a lot of things. I'm a painter and participated in the folk scene in New York back in the 50s and 60s when I was a student, and I was more interested in following Pete Seeger's advice, don't learn from me, learn from the people I learned from, the old-timers, and so that inspired me to go out and look up old-time banjo players or blues performers or unaccompanied ballad singers, you know, preserve some performances that wouldn't have been otherwise.
Art Rosenbaum left the folk scene of the East Village in 1970 and settled in Georgia at the feet of the Appalachian Mountains. He's made a name for himself traveling old back roads and valleys, going to small town churches and farms to make field recordings of what remains of this old folk music tradition.
I like recording on location. You know, I've recorded in churches and people's back porches, and I think the very first field recording I did was of some folks, I guess you'd have to say they're poor whites from the southern states who follow the crops. And there was one particular family, it was a smaller farm, and they lived in a tent, and they were just eating fig bars for several days. But they were the warmest, nicest people. They were from Tennessee, and the mother sang old songs, and the father played the banjo and the fiddle, the old, you know, country breakdowns. And then they had a young son who sang murder ballads. One of them was a short version of Frankie and Johnny, and kind of reminded me of the movie Bonnie and Clyde.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts.
He just sang it unaccompanied.
Oh, how dear they did love. Swore to be true to each other, true as the stars above. He was her man, but he was doing her wrong.
It's part of a new breed of murder ballads based on American true crime. The story of Frankie and Johnny goes that back in 1899 in St. Louis, Missouri, Frankie shot Johnny dead in a fit of rage after finding him with another woman.
Picked up a little 44, gloopity loop, three times she shot right through that hardwood door. He was her man, but he was doing her wrong.
Frankie was a good girl, everybody knows.
In the 1920s, an early blues guitarist was singing about Frankie's revenge in a black dance hall in Avalon, Mississippi. Here's Mississippi John Hurt twisting his own moral out of the tale.
If you don't come to the woman you love, gonna haul you out of here. You're my man, and you done me wrong.
Johnny?
And then there's this version.
Frankie, I beg you, don't shoot me.
Reimagining the cheating Johnny as a handsome riverboat singer, played by none other than Elvis Presley.
From the hottest corner of hell.
Johnny, you're my man, but you're doing me wrong.
It was back in 32 when times were hard. He had a Colt 45 and a deck of cards.
And our taste for blood hasn't slowed. Just as we still turn our head as we drive by a car accident, to this day, contemporary musicians like Nick Cave are still drawn to keeping these mythical bad men alive.
He said, Mr. Motherfucker, you know who I am. And the barkeeper said, no, and I don't give a good goddamn.
The thing that makes a murder ballad compelling is just confronting some of the grim realities of society and of life. You know, what did Woody Allen say? I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens. And confronting it in an art form like in songs, it lets you kind of walk as close as you're comfortable to the fire, go close to the flame in your mind, but step back from it.
Well, those were the last words that the barkeep said, cause they put four holes in his motherfucking head.
Well, I think maybe Stagger Lee needs like another 500 years of people working on it before it'll be a murder ballad. I think it's not old enough yet. I think the ones that are my favorites are the ones that are like probably 1,000 years old. And that's why they have this strange sheen to them. It's because they've been taken up and touched and changed slightly by so many different human psyches that they've reached this nugget of shining aura that is really compelling. I think that's what these songs are trying to do, is talk about things that we don't really have words for. So it's almost like a language. It's a language of signs where dark killer, white beauty meet together in the forest and create a third thing, which is red blood.
The Murder Ballads, produced by Caitlin Gibson with sound engineer Stephen Tilley. Details about the people and the music that you heard on this program can be found on our website, abc.net.au/rn. Look for Earshot on the program menu.